In this lecture, I'm again going to give pride of place to the Augustan era, since it was crucial in the transformation of Greek artistic models into a distinctively Roman aesthetic, even though Greek art had first begun arriving in Rome 200 years earlier. This transformation took place largely due to the guiding hand of the princeps himself, who, as we saw last time, deployed art in the service of a highly distinctive political ideology. Greek, like Roman art, existed in many media: sculpture, painting, and mosaic in the major arts, jewelry, gemstones, and pottery in the minor arts. When Mycenaean civilization collapsed around 1200, there was a clear break in the artistic tradition, which lasted about 400 years. Artistic expression throughout that period, the so-called Dark Age, was rudimentary. Recovery began around 800 BC, or perhaps somewhat earlier, as indicated by the birth of a new style of pottery decoration, known as geometric. The style is so named because of the fondness for many geometric motifs and shapes. Monumental vases in the geometric style sometimes served as grave markers. In fact, much of the finest works of Greek art performed either a funerary or a religious function. It's striking, too, that Greek pottery turns up in Etruscan graves from the 8th century onwards. Early on, it's the Corinthian vases which predominate, but from the mid-6th century onwards, Athenian vases are favoured. The difference between the two is evident in the colour of the clay. Corinthian clay is yellowy, whereas Athenian clay is deep red. It follows, therefore, that since the Romans were in contact with the Etruscans, it's quite possible that they were exposed to Greek art soon after the foundation of their city. The first examples of monumental Greek sculpture date to around 650 BC. The inspiration is believed to have come from Egypt, with whom the Greeks had close trading links, which is yet another indication of how the Mediterranean, throughout antiquity, served as a conduit for the movement of ideas. The earliest sculptural types are that of the standing naked male, the so-called kouros, and the draped female, the chore. However, the earliest sculpture found in Rome, like the bronze she-wolf, a representation of the she-wolf which supposedly suckled Romulus and Remus after they had been exposed by their evil uncle, dated about 500 BC, may well have been made by an Etruscan artist working in Rome. The first contact that most Romans had with Greek sculpture came about during the war against Hannibal, 218 to 201. It took the form of plunder that was looted from the Greek cities in southern Italy and Sicily. The cities that suffered the worst were Capua, Tarentum, and Syracuse. Livy tells us that it was the capture of Syracuse by the Roman general Marcus Marcellus in 212 BC that instilled in the Romans an almost insatiable appetite for Greek sculpture. "From that time," he writes, "came the beginning of enthusiasm for Greek works of art, and consequently of the general license to despoil all kinds of buildings, sacred and profane." The comment about despoiling all kinds of buildings is an interesting one because it displays sensitivity to the artistic integrity of a building that incorporates architectural sculpture into its design. Sculpture, that is, which is designed exclusively with one building in mind. What Livy means is that the Romans weren't content just to plunder freestanding works of art. Instead, they hacked off whatever they wanted from buildings as well, just as in 1801, Lord Elgin removed most of the architectural sculptures that adorned the Parthenon in Athens, including pieces that were still in place, and shipped them back to England. And talking of the Parthenon, one can't help wondering why the Romans didn't despoil that temple of its sculptures too. Evidently, the sculptures didn't have the same appeal for them as they did for Lord Elgin and as they do for us. By divorcing plundered sculptures from their original context, the Romans effectively created the notion of a work of art. They were also the first Mediterranean people to use works of art to demonstrate their cultural sophistication and advertise their wealth. In sum, Art collecting became a central enterprise for the capitalistic kind of society that Rome, from the early 2nd century BC onwards, was fast becoming. It was also around this time, according to the Greek historian Polybius, that the Romans picked up the easygoing ways of the Greeks and began to spend large sums of money on drink, handsome male slaves, and exotic food. Commentators thus saw Rome's appetite for Greek sculpture as part of a much broader phenomenon, one which Pliny the Elder sums up in the word luxuria, meaning indulgence or decadence, whose entry, he would have us believe, demonstrated the pernicious and deleterious effect of contact with Hellenism upon even a highly disciplined people like the Romans. Well, Pliny is writing in the 1st century AD, so it's clear that this theory had a long run for its money. Repeatedly, during the first half of the 2nd century BC, when Rome was fighting wars in mainland Greece and the Greek-speaking East, victorious generals brought cartloads, literally, of looted treasure back to Rome, which they first paraded in their triumphs and then dedicated in her temples in the form of thank offerings to the gods. Now, to give some example of the quantity of plunder that arrived in this way, just consider the triumph that followed Aemilius Paulus's victory over Perseus, the last Macedonian king, in 168 BC. We're told that one whole day barely sufficed for the display of all the statues, paintings, and other works of art that were paraded before the populace, loaded onto, wait for it, no fewer than 250 wagons. Much of the stuff came from the Macedonian royal palace, so it was top quality items. Similarly, Quintus Metellus Macedonicus, the victor in the 4th Macedonian War, 150 to 148, brought back 34 equestrian statues manufactured by Alexander the Great's court sculptor Lysippus. Interestingly, Alexander had commissioned the statues to commemorate his officers who had died fighting the Persians at the Battle of the Granicus River in 334 BC. From now on, they were displayed in the temple of Jupiter Stator, Jupiter the Stayer, beside the Roman Forum, in celebration of Rome's victory over a Macedonian king who had seen himself as Alexander's successor. It was, in fact, common for the Romans to plunder a city and then present their gods with the spoils of victory by depositing artworks in their temples, which thus became repositories of foreign art. Julius Caesar, for instance, dedicated numerous works of art that he had collected in the course of his campaigns in the temple of Venus Genetrix, Venus the Mother, in his new forum in Rome. It nicely justified the act of plunder because the gods, in theory at least, were the beneficiaries. But the Romans didn't stop at that. Individuals despoiled Greek cities of their treasures for their own personal enrichment. The worst offender was Gaius Verres, the rapacious governor of the province of Sicily from 73 to 71 BC. On his return to Rome at the end of his governorship, Verres was prosecuted for his crimes by Cicero. In the courtroom speeches which he delivered against Verres, Cicero listed all the places that he had despoiled of their works of art besides Sicily. They include Chios, Erythrae, Halicarnassus, Tenedos, Samos, Aspendos, and Perge. He doesn't tell us exactly how Verres acquired artworks from all over the Eastern Mediterranean. Verres was extremely wealthy, and he probably got his friends and agents to bully and bribe the locals. Cicero, by the way, had no problem with a Roman official plundering a Greek city of its art treasures, so long as he donated his plunder to the Roman people. And though Verres was exceptional, he was by no means unique. Virtually every Roman governor would have expected to acquire choice mementos of his sojourn abroad, chiefly in the form of Greek statues. So why were the Romans so eager to acquire Greek art, or the closest facsimile thereof, in the form of copies? Pretentiousness had a lot to do with it. In antiquity, as in modern times, being a collector conferred considerable status. But it went far deeper than that. There seems to have been a genuine appreciation for art on the part of most of the elite. I should point out that this phenomenon was limited to the nobilitas. You certainly would not have detected the same enthusiasm among the lower orders. Most plundered art ended up in Rome, where much of it has remained to this day, though unfortunately there are no inscriptions saying generously donated by General X in commemoration of his victory over such and such a city. It's also the case that there existed a very flourishing trade in copies of Greek sculpture, to which I turn next. Because even with the huge amount of plunder, the Roman appetite for Greek art remained unsatisfied. So, from the 1st century BC onwards, workshops in Greece began to produce copies and reworkings of famous statues, which they then shipped off to Italy. And in addition, Greek artists migrated to Rome and established workshops in the capital. One such artist was Arcesilaus, who was commissioned to make the statue of Venus Genetrix for the temple of Julius Caesar that I mentioned a moment ago. It is from these copies and reworkings that our knowledge of Greek sculpture partly derives. From now on, therefore, Roman consumer demand began dictating Greek artistic output, and there was even a trade in making forgeries. Consumer demand was not primarily for the Hellenistic style of sculpture then in vogue, however, in the Greek-speaking world, but rather for the classical style that preceded it. The classical style is today epitomized by the sculptures of the Parthenon. Art historians call the style in which these artists work the Neo-Attic style, since Athens and the region around it, called Attica, was where it flourished. It's highly academic in tone, as in the case of a sculptural relief depicting a fight between a Greek soldier and a wounded Amazon, a scene that is inspired by a depiction on the shield of Athena Parthenos, the statue by Phidias that was carved in wood with overlays of gold and ivory, which stood in the Parthenon. The relief had obviously been intended for export because it was found in the harbour of Piraeus. Neo-Attic art is characteristically described as completely divested of passion. Jean-Paul Morel interestingly suggests that one of the reasons why the Roman nobility was so partial to it was because it helped define the gap between themselves, aloof and self-controlled, and the mob, violent and unrestrained, over which they exercised control. Well, that's an interesting theory if you believe that art addresses a kind of collective view of self. So much of what we think of today as classical Greek art is in fact copies of lost originals that were commissioned by wealthy Roman connoisseurs. Just wander around any museum that contains examples of artworks from antiquity, and many of the labels will read Roman copy of a lost Greek original. Some of the most famous examples of Greek art, including the Apollo Belvedere, the discus thrower of Myron, and the spear carrier of Polycletus, belong in this rather murky, and I might add, rather despised category, Roman copy of a lost Greek original. Roman, in this context, however, means merely produced in Roman times and for a Roman collector. It certainly doesn't mean that the artist himself was a Roman. And even for art experts, the distinction between Greek and Roman sculpture can be extremely, well, indistinct. When the Elgin marbles arrived in Britain, one scholar was of the opinion that they weren't original examples of classical sculpture dating to the 5th century BC, but Roman additions to the Parthenon that had been made as late as the 2nd century AD. One of the biggest collectors of Greek art in the late Republican period was Cicero, and it is just our luck that we have a letter that he wrote to his friend Titus Pomponius Atticus in 67 BC, in which he communicated his passion in no uncertain terms. He says, I've got the 20,400 sesterces for Lucius Sincius, evidently an art dealer, for the statues in Megarian marble. Those sculptures of Hermes in Pentelic marble with bronze heads that you wrote about, I'm already crazy about them. I'd love to have them, along with whatever else seems right to you for my place. If it suits my passion and your taste, as much as you can, please, and as soon as possible, especially the stuff that you think would go well in the gymnasium and the colonnade. Drool, drool. One gets the impression of a kind of feverishness on Cicero's part, of an appetite that is almost spinning out of control. Well, it's one thing to have Cicero's description of his taste in Greek art, quite another to have a visible record of the collecting habits of a wealthy Roman, which is what we actually do have in the case of the so-called Villa of the Papyri, which is located just outside the city of Herculaneum, beside the Bay of Naples. The villa takes its name from the large number of carbonized papyrus rolls, the equivalent of ancient books, some 1,800 in all, that were found in its ruins. Ruins, that is, resulting from the eruption of Mount Vesuvius in late August AD 79. The J. Paul Getty Museum in Malibu, California, which is modeled on the plan of the Villa of the Papyri, accurately renders the spirit of opulence of the original. In addition to the cache of papyri, 24 marble statues and 51 bronze statues came to light in the ruins, the largest number of statues from any single Roman site. Though a few are Roman portrait busts, the great majority of the statues are either Greek or Greek-inspired. They include a large number of busts of Greek philosophers and statesmen, indicating that the owner was a committed Philhellene. Mary Beard and John Henderson described the sculptures as a model of cultivated connoisseurship and super-rich collecting. In actual fact, scholars are fairly sure they know the identity of the owner, Lucius Calpurnius Piso Caesonius, Julius Caesar's father-in-law. Piso, as we know, was a patron of Greek philosophers, in particular of Philodemus, an Epicurean from Gadara in Syria, who came to Italy in 80 BC. Some of the papyri found in the villa contain his prose works. I mention this fact in the context of a discussion about art because it demonstrates that wealthy Roman connoisseurs did not just adorn their homes with fancy Greek artworks. On the contrary, their fascination with Hellenism included philosophy, literature, and language. Indeed, Philhellenes were so Greekified that it affected all their tastes. Their art collecting was merely the most visible aspect of this tendency. Next, I'm going to discuss a few examples of Roman art, which, though they display a dependency on Greek originals, also demonstrate a striking independence that makes them thoroughly Roman. I'm going to begin with the Ara Parcis Augusti, the altar of Augustan peace, which, as we noted in the last lecture, served as an instrument of Augustan propaganda. The altar itself is set on a platform and surrounded by a high screen wall, which is pierced by doors on two of its four sides. The most famous part of the sculptural ornamentation is the frieze, which adorns the upper register of the exterior enclosure wall. It's an example of relief sculpture, sculpture that is carved on a single plane, as opposed to sculpture that is carved in the round. The frieze depicts a procession consisting of about 40 or 50 figures, part of it destroyed, moving in a stately file. Among the figures is the princeps himself, his toga drawn up over his head, indicating that he is a priest. A lot of other figures appear, presumably members of his family, including women and children. Overall, the frieze is very reminiscent of the one that runs around the outer wall of the Parthenon, depicting the Panathenaea, the festival in honor of Athena, in which the entire community participated. The subject matter in both cases is similar. They both depict a community of celebrants. Men, women, and children appear on both friezes. There is the same emphasis upon youth and beauty. And the features of the faces are in each case heavily idealized. Both, moreover, are somewhat propagandist. The Parthenon is a celebration of Athenian democracy and of Athens' victory over the Persians 30 years before, whereas the Areopagus, as its name suggests, is a celebration of the settled conditions that prevailed throughout the empire during Augustus's reign. But there is a difference, and that difference is profound. Whereas the heads of the figures on the Parthenon frieze could have been carved from the same template, those on the Areopagus reveal what has been aptly called an intimate similitude. They demonstrate a strong family likeness, but they are also individualized. And the community is not the community of Rome, in the same way that the community depicted on the Parthenon frieze is the community of Athens. It's the first family in Rome, which, as we see here, is actually rather like any other family in Rome. This is particularly true in the case of the children, who display typically childish responses to this solemn event. There's one that's asking to be lifted up by its parent. The Areopagus also deploys other key elements in the construction of Augustan ideology. Rome's founders are depicted, as two are the goddess Roma and the personifications of bravery in battle and the reward that it brings, namely virtus and honos, honour and virtue. I'll turn next to mural painting, which was also heavily influenced by Greek models. However, and this is important to note, it's virtually impossible in the case of mural painting to judge the quality of a Roman copy, the word is in quotes, alongside anything Greek, because so few Greek examples have survived. By contrast, a lot of Roman painting has survived, though this is entirely accidental. Neither the soil of Greece nor that of Italy is conducive to the preservation of such a perishable artistic medium. But it so happens that many murals have been preserved on the walls of public as well as private buildings in Herculaneum and Pompeii, both of them buried in lava flow in AD 79. It's clear from the evidence of these two cities that well-to-do Romans adorned the walls of their private houses with murals, a practice that does not seem to have been current in the Greek world. The paint was applied on damp lime plaster just after the plaster had been laid on. The technique is known as true fresco, since the term fresco is often misleadingly used to denote any mural. A superb example belonging to the so-called second style of Roman painting comes from the villa of Publius Fannius Sinistor at Boscoreale. Boscoreale is near Pompeii in the Bay of Naples, and was a region heavily populated by the Greeks and one too where Roman aristocrats built lavish villas. The frescoes, dated to about 50 BC, are thought to be copies or adaptations of a cycle of paintings originally designed for the royal palace at Macedon. I can just see old Sinistor licking his lips as he gave instructions to the fresco painters, no doubt Greeks, to decorate his villa with the same set of images that had once adorned the palaces of Hellenistic kings. One of the sources of inspiration for the images was the painted sets of the Hellenistic theatre, as we see from the fact that theatrical masks sometimes appear in them. The paintings include breathtaking vistas that incorporate a variety of architectural elements, many of which appear to be carved out of expensive stones, as we see in the case of Sinistor's cubiculum, or bedroom. It's a barrel-vaulted room with a single window. We see columns, we see a little shrine, all in a dissolving perspective. On the floor, there is a mosaic. Just the sort of thing to have painted on your bedroom walls to help you fall asleep at night. Other Roman frescoes depict scenes from nature, such as the incomparably beautiful garden frescoes from the Villa of Livia at Prima Porta, dated around 20 BC. We used to think that Roman landscape painting was original, but we now know that it too has a Greek precursor. That's because a similarly impressionistic style has been discovered in one of the few sites where Greek frescoes have survived, in the tombs of the Macedonian kings at Vergina. We also know of lost Greek painting through mosaics. A wonderful example of a lost Greek painting that got transposed into the Roman world in this way is the so-called Alexander mosaic, thought to be derived from a painting dated 330 BC. It was found in the so-called House of the Fauns at Pompeii. It depicts Alexander the Great fighting the Persian king Darius III at the Battle of the River Issus. The artist has portrayed the moment when Alexander has Darius in his sights and is ready to strike. One can almost smell Darius's fear. I want to turn finally to sculpture. This was an artistic genre which the Romans made wholly their own by departing completely from the idealized features that characterized its Greek equivalent. There are very few trustworthy Greek sculptural portraits before the Hellenistic period. The portraits of Alexander the Great are heavily idealized. But from 300 BC onwards, there is a move towards more true-to-life sculpture, as in the case of a portrait of the comic dramatist Menander. But Greek portraiture never matched Roman portraiture. The Roman approach has been dubbed a warts-and-all style of depicting the human face because no attempt was made to soften the facial irregularities or to hide the sometimes rather unappealing expressions of the sitters. Its origins are thought to derive from the death masks of ancestors which aristocratic families kept in their houses and which they carried or wore in funeral processions. One of the first Romans to be honoured with a statue was the general Titus Quinctius Flamininus, the liberator of Greece. The statue in question, as we saw in an earlier lecture, was erected by his Greek clients. The work itself is lost, but Flamininus's portrait appears on a Macedonian gold coin that was struck after 196 BC. So, in this medium too, we should acknowledge the importance of Greek influence. It's even been argued, perhaps somewhat humorously, that the realism of Roman portraiture was inspired by Greek artists who employed it as a subversive weapon to convey their dislike of their Roman patrons. Incidentally, we get a very revealing picture of the difference between what was essentially Roman in art and what was essentially Greek from a class of statues that display Roman-style realistic heads on Greek-style idealized bodies. The effect, artistically speaking, is often disastrous, but it illustrates the different tendencies of the two traditions. One instance where the effect is not disastrous is in the case of the Prima Porta statue, where the head of Augustus, idealized admittedly, but nonetheless portrait-based, is attached to the perfectly proportioned body of a classical Greek statue. We should note, too, that the aim of Roman portraiture was not only to memorialize the sitter, but also to circulate his image. The prime example of this, unsurprisingly, involves imperial portraiture. It's been estimated that there were between 25,000 to 50,000 portrait statues of Augustus throughout the empire. Augustus's head also appeared on coins, millions of which, literally, were in circulation. As an aside, the first Roman to mint coins stamped with his own portrait was Augustus's adoptive father, Julius Caesar. In addition, there must have been a multitude of unofficial painted portraits of Augustus that have disappeared without trace. And this means that his face would have been known to virtually all of his subjects, and every future emperor followed Augustus's example in circulating his own image. By contrast, scarcely 100 portraits of Alexander the Great survive, which means that the king would have been completely unrecognizable to the vast majority of his subjects. The numerous coins with portraits of Alexander that have survived were all minted by his successors, eager to claim some attachment to his achievements. Certainly, the fact that Alexander died when he was only 32 had a lot to do with this, but even so, it was his successors who discovered the potency of his image, though they also struck coins with their own heads upon them. To conclude, once Greek artists began working under commission for Roman artists, it's virtually impossible to talk of distinctively Greek as opposed to distinctively Roman art. It's also unclear to what extent artists are dictating taste and to what extent they are responding to their patrons' demands, though the latter is, I think, more probable. Arguably, one of the most important Roman contributions to art was the redefinition of its place and purpose in society, so that it became a legitimate source of purely private pleasure. But it was also the case that the Romans employed art to circulate ideas and promote ideology in a manner that was largely alien to the Greeks. In the next lecture, we're going to investigate an even more significant revolution. We're going to trace the steps by which the Romans became the first people to employ architecture, not to honor the gods, nor to celebrate kings, nor to promote the state as an abstract ideal, but to serve the needs of the masses. And because architecture exists in the public sphere, we shall see that it became arguably the most eloquent expression of the unity of the Mediterranean basin under Roman rule.